Well, thank you, Judith, for the heartfelt introduction. And our topic is cosmic spirituality. And we're using the book, When Catholic Means Cosmic, my book that has as its subtitle, Opening to a Big-Hearted Faith. And for this time, we were reading the introduction in Chapter 1. And then for next time, we'd be reading Chapters 2 and 3. And I'll make reference to the page numbers if I quote from the book. So it's a good idea to bring the book with you each time you come. So I'd like to begin with our affirmation, which shows the kind of spirituality that has the bigness that we're looking for and talking about during these 4 weeks. So does everyone have one of these cards? Okay. And I'll leave some extra ones on the table in the back, so if you'd like one for a friend, help yourself. And this is the affirmation / prayer that I use each day as a way of starting the day, so I also recommend that to you. So I'm going to read it first through alone and then go through it, and then we'll all read it together. I say yes to all that happens to me today as an opportunity to open my heart more and more and to show love to everyone, including me. I dedicate everything that I think, say, feel, and do to the fervent intention of the Sacred Heart of the Universe, a world of justice, peace, and love. Beginning with the saying yes to all that happens, that's the equivalent of thy will be done. Because all that happens is what we call the will of God. So when I say yes to all that happens, I'm beginning in a prayerful way. And secondly, I'm seeing what happens not just as a collection of various events, but as opportunities. And what is the opportunity that all of them have in common that they're presenting to me? It's the chance to open my heart more and to show love to everyone, including myself. And it's okay to include yourself. Then I go to a dedication. And what I'm dedicating is everything that I am, think, say, feel, and do. What am I dedicating myself and all that happens during the day? What am I dedicating that to? I'm dedicating it to an intention that's already alive in the whole universe. There's something in this evolutionary style of our existence that has to do with a direction toward more consciousness, more connection, and ultimately more bliss. That's the intention I'm joining in on. Intention has within it the Latin word tentare, T-E-N-T, that part, means stretch or reach out. There's something happening around us that is reaching out and toward us and through us. And where is it all coming from? Is it coming from like a gigantic mind? It's coming from a gigantic heart. Since this intention of evolution is to keep everything linked, all of nature and all of us, it must be coming from a heart, because linking and connection is the meaning of love. And it's sacred. Sacred meaning that which we can adore, that which we can show reverence to. This heart of the universe is alive with its own intention. What is this intention? It's to have a world of connection, and that connection can only happen if it's a world of justice, peace, and love. So it all comes together, starting from the yes and ending with love. I say yes to love is the same as I say yes to everything that happens, and so forth. I wanted to begin with this because it already shows the kind of bigness that will be our theme throughout our 4 weeks. We want to move from the small, parochial style of faith to a style that is so big that it can embrace the whole cosmos. So now let's say it together, and we're going to pause at the end of each line. I say yes to all that happens to me today as an opportunity to open my heart more and more and to show love to everyone, including me. I dedicate everything that I think, say, feel, and do to the fervent intention of the Sacred Heart of the Universe, a world of justice, peace, and love. Okay, and I purposely, of course, use Sacred Heart of the Universe. We were brought up with Sacred Heart of Jesus. I'm trying to show in all that I do that this heart of Jesus is the same as the heart of the whole cosmos. Well, I'd like to begin with a brief story, something that happened in San Francisco. I was invited by the Congregational Church to give a talk. So the first thing that's different from what happened in our childhood regarding religion is here they are inviting a Catholic person to give a talk to this congregational group. So that's the first thing that's different. But when I arrived at the church, which, and by the way, the talk took place on the day before what we call Palm Sunday. So when I arrived on the Saturday before Palm Sunday, I happened to notice in the corridor as I was walking to the place where I would give the talk, containers of palms in water. So they were kind of keeping them fresh. And I said to the minister, as I walked by, I said, what's the purpose of all these palms? So she said, well, tomorrow's Palm Sunday. So I said, oh, you also celebrate Palm Sunday? Oh, she said, oh, yes, we certainly do. So I thought, okay, that's a little different from, you know, their origins of from the Puritan times and John Calvin and the rigidity, the anti Catholic and anti-ritual styles of Catholicism that their religion is founded on. And she said, we'll be, talking about the part of this gospel that describes what happened on Palm Sunday. So I asked, I said, oh, well, what is the program consist of? And she described what was familiar to me as in our tradition as Mass. In fact, she even said, we use all the readings, we got all our readings from the Catholic ritual of readings. So we use the very same lectionary that is used in Catholicism. And she even said, I thought this was interesting, that we see the consecration not as the part of the Mass that says, you know, the night before he suffered, he took bread and he said, "This is my body." Theologically, that's a narrative, but the actual consecration is when you call down the Holy Spirit, send your Holy Spirit upon these gifts, that they may become the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. She said to me, that's the actual consecration. So I thought, oh, everything here is like kind of familiar. And then she took me into the church, and of course they're style, as you know, is just plain glass windows, no stained glass windows, no pictures, no images. Of course, when I get in there, I see images, stained glass windows. And I said, "Oh, isn't this like not your?" She said, "No, no, we don't follow the old rigid style. This is how we do it now." So that's when I realized that the distinction between all the different religions and, well, ours is like this and theirs is like that. As time passes, we're not seeing the sharp distinctions anymore. We're seeing all the traditions looking at each other and taking what seems to work best for people of today. So I was very impressed by the whole thing, and I thought to myself, well, gradually, we're all kind of learning from each other. And even our churches, which in my childhood were full of statues, whereas modern churches, as you know, they might have two statues at the most. So we're moving more toward their Protestant style, and they're moving more toward ours. And I wanted to begin with this just to give an example of what it looks like when you come from a place of bigness and you don't say to yourself, well, we don't want this because this is what the Catholics do. Or we don't want this because this might look too Protestant. We want to open ourselves to all the traditions. And by the way, as I go along, if you have a question, just come on up. You don't have to raise your hand. And I will also check in with you to see if you have any questions. Well, I'd like to begin with a very simple example of what we mean by moving from a narrow view to a bigger view. So I'm going to begin with the example of public school. I myself went to a public school, grades 1-8. And it was certainly true that the explicit purpose was to give me an education which would basically consist of the three R's, and that the teachers had a curriculum that we would be expected to go through. For instance, when you're in fourth grade, you would be learning certain times tables, and you would be learning certain things about grammar and so forth. So each year had a specific curriculum that the teachers took us through. The teachers were mostly middle-aged spinsters who dedicated their lives to the work that they were doing. When I look back now, I appreciate that about them. I can picture them, and I can see the zeal that they brought to the work. They were really trying to help us learn. They were mostly Irish and we were mostly Italian. And somehow they kept us all in line on a daily basis. But in addition to the education 3 R's curriculum, they were also interested in what they called conduct. Or it was, in some grades, it was called citizenship. And you were also graded on this. And what it meant was that you would be present in an orderly way, and that you would do the work, the assignments that they presented, and that you would not interfere with the smooth running of the class. So you're not going to, you won't be doing that. Later in life, I looked back on this experience from grades 1 through 8, and I had some other realizations. I said to myself, explicitly, they were presenting an education and teaching us about conduct. But wait, there's a picture of George Washington on that wall, and there's a picture of Abraham Lincoln on that wall, and there's an American flag over here. And we started each day with the Pledge of Allegiance and singing the Star-Spangled Banner. And they talked a lot about patriotism. So it occurred to me that part of what they were doing was giving us a sense of duty. To society, to the government. And this meant being a good citizen, which they described in 4 ways. They never said this explicitly, but this is what came through. You couldn't miss this. Obey the laws. What is a good citizen? He obeys the laws, pays the tax, supports the government's policies. If they're going to war, join. This didn't get questioned until the 60s. Whereas I'm describing 40s and 50s. So it's obey the laws, pay the tax, support the government policies, and live in accord with the values of your class, your economic class. All of us were from working class families. So in all the 8 years, there was no suggestion about the importance of going to college. They just imagined that we would, if we were lucky, finish high school. And so 2/3 of us from the graduating class of 8th grade finished high school, and 4 of us from the graduating class went to college. They were not pushing that because they were, shall we say, deputies of working class values and good citizenship. And I'm not blaming them in any way. I just figured, okay, that's the world they lived in, and that's what it was like back then. But that would be an example of something that's basically small because it doesn't expect a lot from you. Now compare that to this. That I hear almost every day on the public radio. It's a description of what will happen when you attend the school a private school here in Santa Barbara. The students will learn to think for themselves, care about themselves and others, and make the world a better place. I'm giving the actual quote. So they're suggesting send your child to this middle school, and as a result, these three things will happen. But these three things were not included in what we experienced. So think for yourself, care about yourself and others, make the world a better place. A radical alternative to just be a good citizen, it will even look subversive to some. It's the opposite of being submissive to the system. So what they're doing is they're presenting the option of going beyond what the system asks for. Everybody follow so far? Now I'm using this as a metaphor. Now I'm going to apply it to religion. So you can either come from this style that I just described, or you can come from, regarding education, the style of the middle school that whose offerings I just quoted. Now let's take religion. Well, we were taught that religion has certain beliefs and that these beliefs are different in each religion and that religions have a moral code, and these moral codes are pretty much the same in all religions, Ten Commandments, and that if you maintain the beliefs and acted in a moral way, you would be rewarded, not necessarily in this life, but in the next life by heaven. What is heaven? A place of eternal happiness with God and all the other people who held on to their beliefs and follow the rules. So the beliefs in Christianity would include, the beliefs in Judaism would include the belief in one God who cares for his people, and the morality is tikkun olam, which is the call to repair the world, make the world a better place. In Christianity, it's the same, plus the belief that God has a son, and he sent this son into the world to be born as a human on Christmas Day, and that he spent his life showing a subversive style of presence in the world, and he was crucified and then rose from the dead. So these would be the central beliefs. Now compare that style of, shall we say, minimal Christianity to the style that we've now been hearing about since Vatican II and especially from Pope Francis. So instead of faith being about subscribing to certain beliefs, it's now to grow in conscious and cosmic faith. Instead of it just being about morality, follow the Ten Commandments, it's build a social conscience, a socially aware conscience that is somehow related to the Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount is a is in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 5. It's an entirely Jewish document. Every word of it is in rabbinical teaching or in the Old Testament. So this is not only Christian, but applies to Judeo-Christian tradition. And in this sermon, he goes beyond just obeying the commandments. He asks that we love those who hate us, bless those who curse us, do good to those who turn on us, and pray for those who mistreat us. So it has an anti-war style. It has a non-violent style. And it's enormously challenging, obviously. But I'm showing the difference in the in what was originally asked for from us and what's possible to be asked for. And if you build your consciousness and have a more of a cosmic faith, build your social conscience, and follow the Sermon on the Mount, then you will be co-creating a world of justice, peace, and love. Just what we were reading in our affirmation. I'll be co-creating a kingdom of justice, peace, and love so that there's a heaven on earth. And when I do talk about an afterlife, I would describe it as Saint Therese did. This is what she said. I will spend my heaven doing good on earth. So yeah, I want an afterlife, but I even want to go on in the afterlife still helping those here on earth. This is also not from Catholicism. This goes way back. Even in pagan times, the ancient Greeks believed that the heroes of the Trojan War were still helping the present-day Greeks in their battles and in their daily challenges. They would call upon the spirits of the ancient heroes. So this isn't new. There's always been something in humans that believed that the ancestors are trying to help us and that we can turn to them. So here we have in what I just described, a radical alternative that is subversive. Subversive in Latin means to turn something upside down. So it turns everything upside down. It's no longer a narrow, I believe, I act morally, and I am rewarded. Belief, morality, heaven. It's no longer like that. Now it's my calling is to go to something much bigger. And that will include a faith that is wide in its embrace, learns from other traditions rather than just the Catholic beliefs from Rome. It's bigger in its morality because it's oriented towards social action. And it even includes the very challenging alternative way of living that's in the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm not looking for just my own reward, heaven. I'm here to co-create in this lifetime and in the next, if there is one, I'm here to co-create a world of justice, peace, and love. And I will spend my heaven doing good on earth. This is such enormous good news. And it fits the consciousness of people like us. This would have been hard to swallow in 1943. But now we've advanced enough so that this could look good to us. We're so lucky to be here while we had the chance to see our faith become bigger, to see it stretch out to its fuller magnitude rather than keep it so narrow. I mean, we were even taught it was a sin to go into a Protestant church. And here they are inviting me to come in, and here I am going in and teaching. And my teaching was just like this. I was saying these same kind of things to them, and they were nodding just the same way you are. We don't want those divisions anymore. We don't want they're like this and we're like that. We're all working together toward what the ad said on the radio. Thinking for ourselves, caring about ourselves and others, and making the world a better place. Barbara Marx Hubbard said something so interesting to me once. I've always remembered it. She said, someday there won't be religions. There'll just be the people with spirituality and the people without. There won't be all these divisions the way we have now. It's hard to imagine that. But that's one possible way things could go. Any questions about any of this part? I'm giving an overall introduction. Hi, Roy. Do you want to come up here, Roy? Then we can hear you better.
Would this be like a mutual, beneficial convergence?
Yes, and convergence is a good word for it. That in Latin means turning toward each other. Converge, turn toward each other. That's a good description of what we're doing. As opposed to, we have all the truth and the others are all wrong, which some of us heard. Other questions? Hi, Mary.
So as I listen to this, I think about the implications for people not coming to churches. There's an article in yesterday's paper about a church in Montecito that was going to try to secede from the U.S. Presbyterian Church, USA. And one of their complaints was that people they're losing members so fast. And but that's not just true of them, of Presbyterian Church, USA. It's true of Catholic churches and others.
Yes, I think it's a wonderfully good sign that people will no longer just go to the feel-good or go to the tradition that reminds us of our childhood. We want something that speaks to us in a new way, that helps us fulfill the five longings that all humans have. For love, meaning, freedom, happiness, and growth. If a church offers those, then it will be appealing. If what it's offering instead is just the familiar style of beliefs and morality, then it will not draw people who have evolved. And of course, we don't want to forget that there are also many people who take the Bible literally, and those churches remain very full, and they are often characterized by values that are anti-human freedom. So we're keeping the idea of the fundamentalist Bible Belt in mind also. They certainly haven't moved into this new view. Jim?
So if people are leaving the churches, how is that a good thing? Because I've always associated church with community. And where are these people going to get a sense of community if they're leaving the churches? What's the alternative?
Yeah, what I'm referring to are the ones that don't offer a sense of community and that don't offer a sense of our place on the planet, planetary consciousness, kind of thing that Pope Francis talked about in his new encyclical. I always think it's a good idea when people no longer just do something out of habit. When they say, okay, this isn't really working, so I'm not going to do it, rather than I'm obliged to do it, so I better go, even though it doesn't have much meaning. When I was a priest, our church had the 7 o'clock Mass, the 8 o'clock Mass, the 9 o'clock Mass, the 10:30 Mass, the 11 o'clock Mass, the 12:15 Mass, the 5 o'clock Mass. And we had upstairs church and downstairs. And they were filled for every Mass. And now those churches just have, maybe one or two Masses on a Sunday because fewer people come. They no longer feel obliged to come as they did in the 1950s and 60s. Hi.
I just want to make a comment to that and then another comment, but the people who are going away from the churches are called nuns.
N-U-N?
N-O-N-E-S.
Oh, N-O-N-E.
Not
okay.
None.
I get it. Yeah.
No, not the others. Yes. But when they question them about their beliefs are still the same as what we're talking about. They just don't find a home in a church.
Mm.
So they, in a way, are progressing in a certain sort of way, but not finding meaning in traditional churches.
Still have a conscience and still
yes.
have beliefs, but
yes.
they just don't find a reflection of all that
right.
enough. They're looking for something bigger.
And my own question was, the new conscience, is it more than just social action? It's the Sermon on the Mount, but what about it also being a relationship with God and the more wider relationship with God than just, I want to do right by you so you love me?
Mm. Good, I'm glad you brought that up. So let's just take a quick look at that. Religion has four... All religions have four components. They all have these in common. So first of all, there will be something that you believe in. So there are beliefs, and these beliefs are stated very clearly. Secondly, they have a moral code of some kind, usually 10 commandments. Third, they have rituals, and these rituals are different in each religious tradition. Although, as I just was pointing out, now there's a crossover. And finally, and this is where I'm responding to Ingrid's question, religions have a component of personal relationship to God as you understand him, her. And this personal relationship is where the mystics are found. And this is where you see devotion. So I have a devotion to the Sacred Heart, and I show it by having a feeling of a relationship to Christ, and I want to exchange my heart with His. This was a style, exchange of hearts, was a style of medieval mysticism. So what they were doing was something different from just beliefs, morality, and rituals. They were going beyond that, feeling like, oh, I'm personally connected, and I have a unique relationship. So the first three are the same for everyone, and the final one is unique. And this unique final component of religion is central to our spirituality nowadays. So while we're at it, let's just look at this. We have beliefs, moral code, and rituals that are described by an institution. And this is called religion. When the beliefs are designed not by an institution, although they may resemble them, but by you yourself, you decide what you believe, you decide on how you're going to be moral, and you decide on your own rituals, like you're going to have a candle or an altar or something like that. When it's personally designed, that's called spirituality. They're really the same, except religion finds these three in very specific ways that have been laid down by the authority figures of that particular religion. So if you were to attend a Sunday service in this Presbyterian church, you would see, you would be present at their kind of rituals with their set of beliefs and their moral code, and that makes you a Presbyterian. But if you design your own, then you call it spirituality. And then the final one, the personal relationship, that one can't be described completely by an institution, so it's already called spirituality. So your spirituality is always personal, and then the beliefs, morality, and rituals connect to the institution. When people say they don't go to church, as Ingrid pointed out, it could be that they still have beliefs, moral code, and rituals, and personal relationship, but they just do it on their own, in their own way. Everybody see this? It's very interesting, isn't it? And it shows that there doesn't have to be such a big distinction between religion and spirituality. So a lot of my spirituality is now affected by Buddhism, a combination of Catholicism and Buddhism. So I'm gaining from more traditions than just one. Hi, John.
Hi, David. I would... Personal relationship,
yeah,
to me, is limiting. I think it needs to be broadened out to this sense of, and what your book is about, cosmic community.
Mm-hmm.
That we are traveling together. We're not just me and God.
Mm.
It is we and God. It's broader. Now, that's I would see personal relationship taking me there, and particularly the mystical experience, because it's the experience of the whole.
Yes. Well, thank you, John. I'm glad you brought that up. And yeah, I missed that. It's personal and interpersonal, is what John is saying, and that makes sense. So it's about me and about my connection to all beings. So even that part has become bigger. So you'll still have a personal relationship, but you will also have a sense of we're all in this together. Good. I'm glad John brought that up. Oh. Okay, so it's time for a short break, and then we will continue.